thing Dick said that I'm going to amend here just a little bit. I know how some of you whippersnappers are. You're thinking, he just told us where all the notes are. We don't have to come back tomorrow. If you think like that, you are going to lose your salvation. And I'm a Calvinist. But I can't help it. But anyway, we're going to talk tonight and tomorrow about issues that will make you very popular around your Thanksgiving and holiday tables if you raise them. You will be the pariah of your family. Aren't you all happy for that? But we're going to talk about tonight the background to the whacked out world of bioethics. Now let me give you an example of what's going on with bioethics and then I'll define it for you. So here are things right out of the press. I pulled these right out of news stories, all right? Here we go. A couple wants a perfect baby. So here's what they do. They pay big bucks to run ads in university campus newspapers throughout the US and Canada that reads as follows. We will pay $50,000 to an egg donor, 5'10", blue eyes, SAT score 1400. 50 grand to get a perfect baby. So that they can take that egg, mix it with donor sperm, and create the ultimate child for themselves. That's going on in bioethics. We now have situations where lesbian couples can have children. I don't know if you knew that. Here's how it works. We take the egg from the one partner, we fertilize it in vitro with donor sperm, we then take the resulting embryo and implant it in the other partner who functions as the surrogate. And voila, you've got lesbian couples having children. This is bioethics. This is going on right now. This is not fantasy. This is not, hey, this is looking 50 years into the future. This is what we're looking at now. You then get a married couple and you think, okay, good, at least we've got that. This married couple then decides they want to create 10 embryos, but they too want perfect children. So here's what they do. They screen, they select a sperm donor, they select an egg donor. They create 10 embryos in vitro. But before these embryos are implanted in the surrogate who will carry the children, they are looked at for possible genetic defects and screened. Any that don't make the grade, we discard them or donate them to research. If they do make the grade, the surrogate will take up to 6 embryos. Now, obviously, you're thinking, how's she going to carry all of those? No problem. Let's say all of them implant. We'll go in and selectively reduce the embryos, meaning abort the ones the couple doesn't want, leaving her with one or two that are her perfect children, the couple's perfect children. This is bioethics. So if I were to sum up what we're looking at as a culture right now, here's where we are. We have become a culture that absolutely will not tolerate imperfection. And boy, do we see it in the field of bioethics. But it goes on. In fact, it gets even worse. By the way, am I the only one hearing an echo, or is there an echo in my... We don't know what that is, and our sound guy has gone for the night. We'll have to genetically alter him for tomorrow. So I don't know where he went, but I'm going to try to fix this by moving this down a little bit.
I don't think it's as bad as you.
It's not as bad as, okay, maybe it's just up here. We are now in bioethics thanks to a movement known as transhumanism. How many of you have heard that word? Transhumanism is not science fiction. This is not going back to the Twilight Zone. What this is a very forward-looking movement that wants to help human beings take mastery of their own evolutionary development. This is a group of academics and scientists who are tired of waiting around for evolution to get its act together to move us forward to the next step. So here's what they're doing. They're doing things like mixing human and animal DNA. flirting with creating new species. That's not the worst of it. They're also making a full-scale attempt to merge machines and humans. In other words, how do you like the idea of living forever in a computer chip? There are people, including high-ranking Google officials, saying that by the year 2045, we will be able to upload your mind to a computer where your thoughts can be there, go in and out of various bodies, other brains, and you would literally live on. And they are working toward a cyber immortality. This is bioethics. It's being talked about and plotted for in serious academic journals. Now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, though I'm tempted. How many of you, again, do not raise your hand, how many of you have heard any of this in your churches? Every summer, I speak at Summit Ministries, which Dick mentioned, Christian Worldview Camp for students. For the last 4 years, I have asked all the students coming through for the summer, roughly 1,400, how many of you in your churches, these are coming from some of the finest evangelical churches out there, how many of you in your churches have heard a presentation on abortion that taught you how to articulate the pro-life view? We get about 40 out of 1,400. Now let's move it to where we're at tonight. Bioethics. How many of you have heard any presentation on a biblical response to infertility? A biblical response to how we should end well death and dying issues? And a biblical response to genetic enhancements aimed at leaping the human race forward to its next step? How many? Out of 1,400, we get about 8 to 9. And we wonder why Christians are being outfought on these issues? So here's what this next couple of days is about. Pardon me. Dick was right. We're going to scratch the surface. What I'm going to try to do, my number one goal here, is not to make you a master of all the topics we're going to talk about. And you'll be happy to know I'm not going to load you down with a ton of technical detail. That's not going to happen. The notes that you're getting will cover everything that I'm going to highlight here. You will not have to take notes faster than broke people at a Dave Ramsey seminar to keep up with what I'm doing, okay? You can just follow the notes. What I hope to do in the next 2 days is make you interested enough to go read and pursue this issue. We have back there a couple of great resources. We have Gilbert Nylander's book on bioethics. This is a fantastic overview of what we're dealing with in the culture right now, and he does a very good job of dealing with it from a Christian worldview. We also have a more basic packet. We've got a copy of my book, The Case for Life, and a DVD of me debating the former president of the ACLU on abortion at Wayne State University. $20 gets you that. And then we have my other book, Stand for Life, and Case for Life, and the debate DVD. $25 gets you everything. So those are available. Not trying to do a hard sell on that. Your salvation rides on you not getting the notes, but it doesn't ride on you buying the books, so that's all right. So these are the real things we're facing right now in bioethics, men and women, and Christians are going to have to either come up with good answers on these topics, or we are going to, does that mean you can't hear me or you can? Hearing is enhanced? We're good. All right, glad to hear you. We have not faced these kinds of issues before in the church. We're facing them now, and we have to know what to do about it. So what is bioethics? Let me define it for you so you know what it is. Bioethics differs from medical ethics. Medical ethics is you're in the hospital, you have a doctor, you got a doctor-patient relationship. That's more along the lines of medical ethics, how we treat individual patients. Bioethics go up 64,000 feet. It's asking fundamental worldview questions that go way beyond the individual practice of medicine. For example, Bioethics is asking the question, what does it mean to be human, and should we even care? Does it even matter? What makes humans valuable? Are we valuable because of what we do functionally, because of our level of cognitive development? Or are we valuable by nature, simply because we're human? Bioethics is engaging that question. When is it okay to withdraw or withhold treatment from people at the end of life? When is that okay? That's a bioethics question. How about beginning of life issues with infertility? That is a bioethics question. And then, of course, the biggie, the one that's going to be the elephant in the room the whole time we're together here, is human nature fixed? Or are we free to redraw it like a congressional district? That's what we are up against. That was a political joke. I thought with the election I'd get a little better response from that. Went down faster than provisional ballots in a classroom in Florida this week. These are bioethics issues we're all going to have to deal with, and as Christians we want to make sure that we know how to answer, and here's why we need to know how to answer right. Bioethics is not neutral. Here goes, and I'm prepared to fight over this and defend the thesis I'm about to throw out to you. Bioethics is no friend to the Christian. It is threatening the very foundational dignity of humanity. And we're going to see that in three key areas, starting tonight and into tomorrow. First area we're going to see that is the beginning of life, assisted technologies. The second area will be end-of-life issues, and then we're going to conclude tomorrow with what is probably the scariest, the whole transhumanist movement to try to enhance human beings to be something way beyond where they are right now. These are threats on human dignity. They're not just abstract things out there. They threaten the very nature of who we are as persons. And the three key areas I just mentioned, infertility, beginning of life issues, end of life issues, and genetic enhancements, will impact all of us, no exceptions. Just out of curiosity, how many of you here tonight have walked a loved one through the final chapter of life? And you've been down that road. Yeah. And you know, some of you may, as I learned when I did this with my sister, that there's a lot of pressure on you to make decisions that you better have thought of in advance, because it's real tough in that moment to think clearly. We're going to help you think a little clearly on those issues. That'll be the topic of tomorrow morning's session. How many of you know people in your churches who struggle with infertility and it's been devastating for them? Yeah. By the way, just think for a moment. What does Mother's Day look for? Or what does Mother's Day look like in a local church when you're a couple that has been trying to have your own children for 22 years and all the little kids go up there on stage, get their flowers, and bring them to mom? Where's your flower? These are real people in our churches. We need better answers than, well, maybe God just doesn't want you to have kids. Can you imagine the pain of what that would feel like to somebody struggling with infertility? It would be devastating. In grad school at Biola, one of my professors was Dr. Scott Ray, who's written voluminously on Christian ethics. And he had his wife talk to us one day. And she talked about how she had been through cancer and infertility. And she said if she had to do it again, she'd pick cancer any day over infertility. These are people in our churches. Who's talking to them? Do we have answers? Do we have an idea of what we ought to be doing to help them navigate that ethically and pastorally? These are real people struggling. And then, one of the most interesting things at Summit over the last 4 to 5 years, when it comes to the issue of genetic enhancements, altering the nature of what it means to be human, here's what we're finding at Summit, at a Christian worldview camp. The students are absolutely with us on abortion. Abortion's wrong? No way. Not doing that. They're with us on doctor-assisted suicide. We're not going to intentionally kill people at the end of life. either through giving them drugs or euthanizing them. They're with us. All of a sudden, though, when the topic becomes, should Christians just accept wholesale the idea of redefining human nature so that we can do more stuff cognitively, the pushback is unreal. Now think about it for a moment. What have students been raised on for the last 15 years in movies and on television? Superheroes. Superheroes. While we've been in our churches having nice game nights, Hollywood has been training them how to think about transhumanism right under our noses. Amen. That's scary stuff. So the fact you're here tonight and will be here tomorrow because you all want to be saved is a warming thing for me. It warms my heart to know that you're here and that you care enough to begin exploring these topics so that we can make a difference on them as Christians and begin to do something. Now, here's what's interesting. Right now, our culture is telling Christians you have no place at the table when it comes time to talk about bioethics. You don't even get to join the conversation because your views are all religious. You've heard this before, right? Oh, you're just your religious view. What has happened in the culture is the idea of faith has been stripped from the idea of knowledge. Here's what faith means to the secular culture, and sadly, dare I say, to large numbers of Christians. Faith does not mean trust based on evidence. It means a leap in the dark, belief in spite of evidence. In fact, you've probably heard this too, Christians who say that somehow that's more virtuous to believe something when there's no good reason to believe it. Really? Where does the Bible teach that? And the answer is it doesn't. Faith is not a blind leap in the dark. It's trust based on evidence. I got on the jet plane to fly here yesterday. It was snowing in Minneapolis. But I had faith that I would get to Billings. Why? Because there's two guys in the cockpit in uniforms with thousands of hours of flying experience. I'm on a reputable airline. Yes, Delta stands for don't expect luggage to arrive, but you will. You will. On top of that, I'm part of a nation with a remarkable history of air safety. So I had faith, but it was not blind faith. I had good reason to believe what I did. What's happened in bioethics is we have seen a total bifurcation of knowledge on one hand and faith on the other. And when it comes to religion and ethics, you know what the secular culture says? That's the private sphere. That's the personal, subjective realm. The only thing that counts as real knowledge is science. That's a worldview known as scientism. Scientism says the only thing that counts as truth with a capital T is what we can smell, taste, see, and hear. If you can't empirically engage with it, it's not real truth. And because religion and ethics aren't measured empirically, the culture tells us, therefore, as Christians, we have nothing to say to the real world on the major issues of our day. So you get a guy like Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker is a philosopher at MIT, and here's what Steven Pinker says about human dignity. Get ready. It's profound. Here it is. It's stupid. And he's ready to fight about this. It's stupid. You know why it's stupid? Because it's just Christians trying to smuggle their religious view into bioethics. And we don't need human dignity to do bioethics. All we need is consent and autonomy. That's all we need. And by the way, he says, do not even think about bringing a larger worldview into debates over bioethics. All we need, he says, is scientific materialism. Whoa, wait a minute. Is scientific materialism a worldview? You better believe it is. It says that the only thing that's real is what you can see in the physical realm. It says that the universe came from nothing and was caused by nothing, and that human beings, therefore, are nothing but cosmic accidents with no intrinsic value. So no wonder he hates dignity. Men and women, that is a worldview every bit as big as the Christian's worldview. Now, let's look at the two here for a moment. You got two competitors right now. I'm sorry, I'm preaching tonight, but here goes. You got two competitors. You got Christian theism, which we all agree is religious. You got scientific materialism or naturalism, which we all agree is religious here, but they don't think it is. But wait a minute. Aren't both views asking the same questions? Here's a little hint. Everybody at the table discussing these issues brings prior worldview assumptions to the table that cannot be proven empirically. So I'm going to throw out my five big words for the first session tonight, then there will be no more big words, okay? The first big word is metaphysics. Some of you are like, I'm out of here now. Doors are locked, you're going nowhere. Now, metaphysics doesn't mean to freak you out. It just means, what is the nature of ultimate reality? That's all it means. Is ultimate reality spirit like God or strictly material like stuff? That's metaphysics. Scientific materialism says the only reality is stuff. Christian theism says there's stuff plus stuff we don't measure empirically, like the laws of logic, like the idea that my mind can make contact with the outside world. You don't prove that stuff empirically. We believe there's truth beyond what we measure empirically. Then here's the second big word, and it gets real easy after this one, okay? So just really only two big words. The next big word is epistemology. Both sides do epistemology. Epistemology is simply how we know things. The secular worldview says the only way we can know things is through the five senses. The Christian worldview says no, there's things we can know philosophically and theologically that are also true with a capital T. The third area where both worldviews are playing the same question is ethics and morality. What's wrong with us? The Christian worldview says that what's wrong with us is we've rebelled against our Creator, who created us for His glory, and we have a huge sin problem. And guess what? We can't fix ourselves. God had to intervene in history to do it for us, and thank goodness He did. That's the Christian fix. Our problem is sin. The fix is the salvation found in the atoning death of Jesus Christ. That's the Christian fix. The secular fix, the scientific fix, says the real problem isn't sin. The real problem is we don't have the knowledge to overcome death, sickness, and the limitations of our own nature. And the way we fix ourselves is to take the next step forward in the evolutionary process. You see how everybody's asking the same question? Our view is no more religious than theirs. And yet it's only ours that gets tossed. They're asking the same exact questions. The problem is they're coming up with the wrong answers. They're looking for substitute saviors. This shouldn't surprise us, men and women. Didn't Paul say in Romans 1-3, that God has written His laws on everyone's heart? Yeah. That lost neighbor of yours who thinks your Christian faith is complete hooey, in his heart of hearts, he knows something's desperately wrong. Not only with the world, not only with politics, but him. Your answer is, yeah, I know there's something wrong with me. I'm broken. I'm messed up. I'm a sinner. I need Jesus and His righteousness. He doesn't have that option. He's looking for a technological savior that will give him immortality and the ability to transcend current limits. And that's why we've got bioethics the way it is today. Everybody's asking the same fundamental worldview questions. We're also asking the same question of, what is anthropology? What does it mean to be human? Here's the secular answer. The secular answer of what it means to be human is you are nothing more than a wired machine. That's all you are. You're just physical stuff. Your mental states are really just brain states. There's nothing more to you than the hard wiring in your body through chemistry and physics. The rest is just fantasy. It's myths you believe to give your life meaning, but there's really nothing more to you than an accidental arrangement of cells. The whole blind watchmaker thesis of Richard Dawkins. That's their anthropology. We also have an anthropology. No, human beings do have bodies. Bodies matter, but we are a dynamic union of body and soul, and we bear the image of our maker, and our dignity comes from not our functions, but whose image we bear. They have an anthropology, we have an anthropology. So again, why do we get tossed as being religious when we're all doing the same thing, answering the same fundamental questions here? There's one other area that we overlap on our questions with our secular friends, and that is on cosmology. How did we get here? Where are we going?
Scott,
yeah?
Is that turned off?
I don't know. That's a good question. Yes, it is. It is. Its anthropology is dead. How did we get here? Well, you know what the secular worldview says. Universe came from nothing, was caused by nothing. Human beings, therefore, are cosmic accidents. They're really intrinsically nothing to them. The Christian worldview says no. History has a purpose. There's a sovereign God directing things, and we are all part of his story. Again, does everybody, please tell me, you shake your head, you're getting this. Everybody's asking the same questions, aren't we?
Yes.
Everybody. So you don't have to think of yourself as a nutcase because you're a Christian answering these questions. They're answering them too. The only question is, which worldview does a better job explaining them? And I argue it's the Christian worldview that puts us in a position to deal with bioethics, deal with some of the things we're dealing with in the culture today, and that's what we'll spend our weekend doing at today. The very term dignity has been turned on its head. Let me give you a corrective right out of the gate. We live in a postmodern culture, that is true. Postmodernism is the belief that there's nothing real beyond your own perceptions. That's it. That's it, the loose definition of postmodernism. A lot of people think that when it comes to topics like bioethics, nobody believes there's truth anymore on anything. People say that, I get that. But you know what's happening more accurately? They're taking our biblical notions of dignity and turning them on their heads and redefining them right under our noses. So let me give you an example. Dignity biblically means this. You, strictly because you're a human being, with no other qualification necessary, you have value and a right to life simply because you're human. That's it. You're not valuable because of your cognitive abilities. You're not valuable because you can function a certain way. You're valuable strictly because of whose image you bear. That's the biblical notion of dignity. But that has now been changed. We are now under what Roberta Amundsen calls the new dignity. The culture is still using the term. The culture looked at Steven Pinker when he called dignity stupid, and they said, "Nah, I don't think you quite got that. But we're going to redefine it." So here's the new dignity. The freedom to reinvent myself any way I want. If I want to marry my canary, I can do it. That's a great Coca line, and it's a good one. If I want to marry three other people, dignity means I get to do it. If I want to choose the time that I'm going to die, and force you as a medical staff person to help me accomplish that, you will help me do it because I have dignity. If I want to manufacture children to suit my own preferences as a parent so I am fulfilled by these children rather than receiving them as gifts, dignity says I get to do that. This new dignity, as Amundsen points out, is nothing more than an unadulterated will to power. And this is why we get people claiming to pluck rights out of thin air right and left. I have a right to not be offended. That's the new dignity. Don't you dare say anything that troubles me. that offends me. Because if you do, you're offending my dignity. It's not about what I am intrinsically, it's you getting out of the way of anything I want. That is the new definition of dignity, and that is driving bioethics. A patient wants to die, we're going to force pro-life doctors to help, and if they don't, we're going to force them out of business. What? You're not going to help this woman have an abortion, and you won't refer her to a doctor who will? You're offending her dignity. You're in the way of her self-image of what she thinks matters. You're going to have to go sell newspapers then. This is the new dignity. And of course, when you are a Christian and you claim there's moral truth to be known on these issues, well, now you're also intolerant. You're not only offending someone's dignity, you're also intolerant. Welcome to the world that we're in, men and women. It's a rough one. And it's one that we're going to have to be very good at learning how to bring our Christian worldview to this culture we're in today. Feminist Camille Paglia put it this way. Camille Paglia, pardon me. I'll just quote her. It's a phenomenal quote. She says, "Fate, not God, has given us this flesh." What's the cosmology involved there? Yeah, Darwinian evolution. Fate, not God, has given us this flesh. We have absolute claim to our bodies to do with as we see fit. End quote. I want you to think about this for a moment. To you, that sounds like, are you kidding me? But what if your worldview is that the universe came from nothing and was caused by nothing? There's no intrinsic dignity to you or anybody else whatsoever. Why not re-engineer human nature? Why not make you 10 times smarter than you are now? Why not make it so you can move faster? Why not do anything you want with your body? Because your body is just matter in motion. That's it. No purpose to it. The worldviews that are driving bioethics are what we as Christians have not been focusing on. We get all offended at the stuff the culture does. We're not asking the question, what's the worldview driving them to do that? Why do they think that way? So part of what I will do in the session tonight and tomorrow is talk about the worldviews that are lingering there and what we can do about it as Christians, how we can engage them, how we can make a difference to people who think that their bodies mean nothing, that they mean nothing, and help them understand there's way more to this than just what they think is in play here. A lot more that impacts them, their kids, and everyone else. So now, let me ask a question. How many of you have ever heard about uploading your minds to a computer? Yeah, a lot of the young folks are, yeah. I mean, how would you like that? You've got your mind on display, there in a file somewhere out there in cyberspace, and that could be used to bring you back, so to speak. Now, by the way, this isn't going to happen, and I'll explain tomorrow why it's not going to happen. But it's being talked about. And what does this do to the concept of human dignity when you reduce human beings to mere computer chips? Yeah, this is big stuff, and we wonder why. The culture has no problem with identifying however you want. Did you see, speaking of the new dignity, did you see the guy earlier this week that identified, he's 69, he identified as a 49-year-old? Yeah, we're all laughing. But wait a minute. He's right. If I'm free to make myself up any way I want, according to the new dignity, why can't he be a 49-year-old? Maybe he was getting ready to register at one of those dating sites. I don't know. But I mean, seriously, why not? Have you seen the video of that guy? Forget his name. He's the conservative video maker guy. He goes on college campuses and he interviews students. And he walks up to, this is a video that's a couple years old. Maybe some of you saw this. He walks up and says, "I'm identifying..." Now, keep in mind, he's 6'6". He says, I'm a 4'8" Asian female. And they're freaking out like, no way, dude, you're tall. No, that's what I identify as. That's who I am. Students have no answer for him. They can't. Because that's the culture they've bought into. And yes, it's absurd. Yes, we're laughing about it. But it is going to lead to the dehumanization of all of us. Scary stuff. This is bioethics. Well, have I captured your attention at least a little bit for the topic we're going to look at? I promised Dick that I would quit by 8, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop for a few minutes here, take a few questions, and then I have one last thing to say before we quit at 8:05, give you a short break, and then we're going to come back and go right into the specific topics. We're going to go right into beginning of life issues, assisted reproductive technologies, and how we should think about those as Christians. So let me stop right there. Based on the introduction of what I've said so far, what questions can I answer? Yes, sir.
Can you talk about the interface between naturalism and postmodernism? Because scientific materialism, as you talked about, has a very definite picture of what truth is, whereas postmodernism, everything's squishy, and yet those are two very strong worldviews, and how they interface, because it makes the game really slippery for us.
Yeah, how do postmodernism and modernism interface? Modernism was the belief that using empirical fields of investigation, we could get at truth with a capital T. Religion can't get us there, but at least empirical pursuits can. Postmodernism says we can't get at anything, really, because we're all trapped behind our own sense perceptions or language communities. How many of you have heard the parable of the blind men and the elephant? Have you heard that story? The story goes like this. There's a group of, 10 to 12 blind Indian men, and they're touching an elephant. And the first blind man says, oh, the elephant is like a tree trunk. He's got his hands around the elephant's leg. It's like a big tree trunk. The other blind guy says, no, it's like the tip of a spear. He's got the tusk. The other says, no, it's like a big snake. He's got the trunk. You get the picture, right? And finally, this Indian, I forget what they call him, but the wise guy, appears in the balcony and says, no, you're all wrong. Each of you is only experiencing a part. The elephant is way more than all of that. And the story is supposed to tell us that none of us can see everything, therefore we shouldn't claim to have capital truth when it comes to knowledge, or capital T when it comes to truth and knowledge. But of course the obvious question is, wait a minute, where are you in this story? How did the guy in the balcony get privileged access to see everything? If we're all blind, how did he get to see everything and know that we're all blind? See the problem? And this is the problem with postmodernism. It's self-refuting. It says that there's nothing true out there, but how does it know that? How can it claim universally there's no truth while denying such a thing even exists?
Is that true?
Here's where the two interface. The vast majority of people you meet are postmodern when it comes to religion and ethics, but they're modernists when it comes to science. In fact, William Lane Craig says this in his book, Reasonable Faith. If they are sick, they're not asking the doctor to just give them a series of pills and they'll just pick one based on what they feel like. No, they want to know where's the amoxicillin or whatever it is they need. So they're empiricist when it comes to science, but not religion and ethics. That's the interface. And in bioethics, what's happening is scientism is the worldview driving bioethics. Scientism being the belief that all truth is scientific truth. Which, by the way, that's a self-refuting statement. Self-refuting statements are statements that falsify themselves. I'll give you an example. My brother is an only child. Somebody going, I saw him on Oprah. He was really good. Don't take anybody's advice on anything. You're in rare form as usual. Think about that one.
I forgot to warn you that this guy is into logic. Can you hear it? It's good. Go ahead.
I can't speak a word in English. The Broncos are going to win the Super Bowl. No. What's wrong with all those things? I just lost half the crowd. But that's just your view. What's wrong with all those statements? The minute you say them, they're falsified, right? You're in rare form as usual. If you need help on that one, coffee will be available in the break. I can't speak a word in English. Obviously, I just did. These are statements that literally commit suicide the minute you say them. When someone says science is the only truth, what kind of statement is that? Scientific or philosophic? Philosophic. It's just like saying my brother is an only child. It refutes itself, and yet that is the principle driving bioethics. And it is that principle that science alone gives us truth and religion and ethics just gives us subjective opinion that puts the experts in charge of all these moral decisions they're not qualified to make, which will be the topic we'll discuss tomorrow. Okay, so we're going to, I'll take one more, sure. I'll take one or two more.
Hey, Scott.
Hey.
Hey, my name's Abram. Thanks for coming, by the way. It's just a treat to listen to you. More of a comment that I would like you to speak to with respect to something that you just said. A little closer. Oh, I'm sorry. Realize. One can sympathize with the greater credence that something like scientism has because of its ability to produce results.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you would offer some commentary on how great it could be if ethics and religion were more ostensibly effective, rather than just being...
What do you mean by effective?
Producing visible, undeniable, maybe, results.
What do you mean by results?
For example, I was at the bank a while back. There were couple people in front of me that couldn't speak English. I was able to render meaningful service to them, helpful, because I speak Spanish.
Yeah.
That's different from being, from only being able to say, hey, I'm really sorry, there's nothing I can do for you, I wish I could help, but I really feel, I empathize with your struggle. And I'm afraid that too often religion falls into the second category, where you have people curing illnesses, say, with amoxicillin, and prayer not rendering the same results,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes. And then, for the honest skeptic, they're looking at it and going, well, if you're praying and nothing's happening, but the amoxicillin is helping,
sure.
You're going with science, dude. Your religion is bogus.
Yeah.
So that's what I was wondering. If you
sure, absolutely. By the way, anybody who thinks Christianity teaches that every time you pray, you get what you want has bad theology. They haven't studied Christianity. Now, I get it if you're Benny Hinn, you believe that, maybe. But not anybody who is more orthodox in their Christianity. In fact, Christianity fully accepts our finality as human beings and fully embraces the empirical quest to make human beings better. In fact, in the next session, I'm going to talk about how God has given us knowledge to reverse the impact of the fall, and Christians are, hey, bring it. Here's the difference. As Christians, though, we think knowledge for advancement must be tethered to moral truth. Science alone doesn't get to command the field. If it does, the Tuskegee experiments were perfectly permissible. Because what we said there was, we took African-American men who were suffering from syphilis, dying from it. We promised to cure them, but instead we gave them sugar pills because what we really wanted to do was study how the disease killed them. We would never do that to a white person, but by golly, we'd do it to blacks. Science couldn't tell us that was wrong. Science could only tell us what would cure the men. We needed religion and ethics to tell us how to use the science appropriately. That's the merge between the two. They both need each other. They're overlapping disciplines. One does not command the field over the other. In fact, science presupposes philosophy. You cannot even do science without presupposing philosophy.
Absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. So the two are not separate enemies.
I'm not suggesting that. But just because I think you can take this, you're not speaking to my question.
Okay, go ahead.
My question was just if you have two things, two options,
yeah.
to look to for your answers to your questions in life, and one is producing obvious results,
right.
And the other one is not. It's like wait until you die and then you'll find
but
out.
You didn't answer mine with all due respect, because I asked you what are the ultimate results, what are the ultimate things that matter, and you gave me a story of someone at the bank. I need to know what is, see, we're both asking, we're going right back to the point I made earlier. We're both asking the same metaphysical questions here. And all I'm saying is science doesn't get to rule the field. We can do both. Christians embrace both. What we don't accept is scientism that says science alone counts as truth with a capital T. I don't deny science.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that.
Okay. I think we agree that. All right, one more. You're right, by the way, I can take it, so you can ask more if you want. Anybody else? Okay, we're going to take a break.
Wait,
I've
got one over here. 2 minute question.
I think I just maybe want to clarify what he's asking, perhaps. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I think what he's asking is, how can we as people of faith talk to people who are scientific-minded? I think he brought up the story because of the language barrier, and there's a language barrier between people of faith and people who do not have faith at all. I personally that we cannot separate science and religion as Christians. We need to be fully studious in both sides so we can have an intellectual conversation with intellectuals who
absolutely
have absolute no faith. And now that we do bridge the barrier.
Did she clarify what?
No, but I'm
okay.
She need not clarify.
Okay.
I'm glad she commented.
Okay. Go ahead.
And that is kind of my own question is, I personally am not a confrontational person. I do have a degree in biblical studies and theology, so all that you're saying is reminding me of a lot of my studies. So, for example, I'm equipped, but I have a really hard time bringing up a conversation like this with, let's say, somebody on a plane or a client that I might have. And so I would like to know, what are some easy ways, if that's even possible, to engage a person in a non-confrontational way, just a casual way, so you're not dying on a hill by yourself and all your friends and family want to disown you.
Well, you lost me when you brought up the plane thing, because I'll be honest, I'm not like some who get on a plane and try to lead the whole plane to Christ before we get out to LaGuardia. That's where Calvinism is advantageous. I can take a nap, God save who he wants, and I sleep, right? But you raise a great point, though. And there is a language barrier. If we are coming at people with the tools of rhetoric that I think we've maybe used in the past. Look, the point's well taken. If somebody's sick, I don't say, I'm going to pray for you, don't take the medicine. I'm going to give them the medicine and I'm going to pray for them. I'm going to do both. I'm not going to pick one over the other. I give them the pills. In the same way, I think we can engage people on thoughtful questions, and instead of saying, and here's one thing I try to get Christians not to say. I don't think we should say to the world, we know for certain we're absolutely right. Could we be wrong? The answer is yes. It's possible God does not exist. I mean, can we prove beyond all doubt that God does not exist? I don't think we can. Now, having said that, how many things do you know beyond all doubt in life? How many? Very few. Do I know for certain right now that my wife is at home and not in Las Vegas marrying Michael Jackson while Elvis does the music for the ceremony? By the way, I'll have to kill any of you that let this out of the room, and I'm pro-life. All right, now. I can't prove that beyond all doubt. Now, do I have any good reason to believe that? No. And this is the thing about the Christian worldview. What we're arguing as Christians is that our worldview makes more sense and is more reasonable to believe than alternative explanations. And we can claim our worldview is true with a capital T, even if we don't have bomb-proof certainty on everything. I can claim it's true with a capital T, my wife is at home right now in Newton, Georgia, with my kids. Even though somebody could say, well, no, you can't prove that for sure. if the burden would be on them, quite frankly, to prove it. So I think we can engage people on the ground rules to start off. You know, you might start with something like, well, what does it mean to be human? Ask good questions. Greg Kokel's Columbo tactics, for example. What does it mean to be human, and why do you think that way? What led you to that conclusion, and have you thought through the implications of that view? You know, you say that humans only have value when they're self-aware, but what about newborns who aren't self-aware until several months later? I mean, just thoughtful questions where you're not preaching, you're not being, you know, you're not bringing the four spiritual laws to them while they're at 40,000 feet and can't escape you because you've got them locked in at the window. You're, you know, I don't know, does that, I don't know that I'm helping, but yeah.
Thanks, we're gonna take a break. But before we do, I wanna honor a couple people. We have several pastors. Pat, if you're a pastor, would you stand for a moment, please?
Give it up. Yeah.
Here's the deal. We're starting in 10 minutes with you or without you.